This is the Smallmouth Crush Podcast. If you're a hardcore angler, you've come to the right place. This is a weekly podcast that will interview some of the top smallmouth bass anglers in North America. Travis and his guest will discuss what it takes to consistently catch big smallmouth, and you'll get a glimpse inside the mind of a trophy smallmouth angler. And now, here's your host of the Smallmouth Crush Podcast, Travis Manson.
Hello, welcome to the Smallmouth Crush Podcast. My name is Travis Manson. Another unbelievable week talking smallmouth fishing. I'm ready. It's been a week. I hope you guys are loving this podcast. We're talking with some of the greatest smallmouth bass anglers across the country and learning a ton along the way. At least I know I am, and I hope everybody out there appreciates this valuable information. We got a great guest tonight, Michael Simonton. He is a smallmouth stud. He knows how to put some big smallmouth in the boat. And I think he likes to fish Lake Erie quite a bit. So all you Lake Erie listeners want to learn big water smallmouth techniques, I think this is going to be a good one. But let's talk about the Reel Shot real quick. Easy to shop website will make selecting baits for your next tournament or maybe big bass adventure super, super easy. They carry all the name brands and some hard to find brands. So you're going to find your Mega Bass, Jackals, Evergreen, Z-Man, of course, Dirty Jigs, Kitex, all kinds of rods and reels, Daiwa, Shimano, you name it, St. Croix. You get the picture. Head on over to the reelshot.com. You can use my code smallmouthcrush15, and that's going to give you 15% off your first order. So head on over, tell them Smallmouth Crush sent you. And let's get into it. Let's talk smallmouth fishing with Michael. And here he is. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. How are you, man?
Oh, can't complain, you know. Loving it.
We are hopefully going to share some things that have been helpful for me out on the water. And hopefully you can share some important little details, too, that I can use out on the water.
Well, I think both of us here are going to be able to drop some knowledge on the listeners and the viewers. Of course, this is on all the podcast networks as well as my YouTube channel, Smallmouth Crush. If you are watching, we do want to make sure we got the video going for this great content as well. But Michael, I want to start out with just introduce yourself if you could. Let us know what part of the country you're from as far as your home body of water. I'd like to know really how you got into fishing, if this was something you've done all your life or if this is something, you know, you picked up through the years.
So I'm from Northern Ohio, small town called Fremont. So it's just where the Sandusky River meets Sandusky Bay. Joined a bass club when I was 16 years old, and we just fished up around, you know, Port Clinton, Sandusky, Ohio area. And I think, you know, a lot of guys, I'm 40, you know, a bunch of guys my age and a little bit older, seeing the Bassmasters on TV, something just clicked in us where we just thought that was our thing. That was awesome. It wasn't basketball for me, anything like that. So got into a bass club, and it just kind of rolled into that for, the competition. I played soccer, a bunch of other sports. That all ended. So the fishing really, the competition side really helped fill that void for competition. My grandmother had a cottage on one of the islands on Lake Erie called South Bass, Putin Bay. You know, I think 3 or 4 days after being born, my parents had me over there. So I've been around the islands and Lake Erie my whole life. From my house in Fremont, you know, we're not like Port Clinton right on the water, but I could be from Fremont to Port Clinton at the time, you know, in about a half hour. Now I lived just east of Sandusky, in a little town called Berlin Heights. Now I can get out to the Bass Islands, be fishing in about 40 minutes. So I'm under an hour. You know, we have some great fishing around here. You know, started off doing a lot of largemouth fishing. My whole goal my whole life was to become a professional bass fisherman. That's all I wanted to do. You and I actually, back then we didn't know each other, but that first year you fished the Opens, it was 2010 or 11, and you qualified that year, I think. Yeah, and I just missed out and was an alternate, but Made it the next year, won the Northern Points, and quit my job. I was a school teacher. Quit my job, and you know, we were down in the St. John's River, and then March. Did that for 3 years on the elites, wasn't very successful. So got out, went back to teaching. And during around that time, I started a guide business, and I was kind of frustrated at the time. My whole life was to become a better fisherman, to be a touring angler. Like, I just love the lifestyle, the traveling, different towns, different lakes, campgrounds, everything about it. So I wasn't depressed or anything like that. I was okay up here, but I wanted to know what I was going to do with my, like, I felt like I had a skill set in fishing and I wanted to know what I wanted to do. And I was wondering if that passion was going to leave me. Like, I was curious, since that dream is over, most likely. I mean, someday I could go do it again, I guess, but if I got that burning desire. But I was really curious on how I was going to react to not chasing that dream anymore of qualifying for the elites. And I wanted, like, it was a real change for me to not have that, always driving after something. But then I was like, man, I really like guiding a lot, you know? So I was like, that was going to be my focus, you know, tracking the smallmouths out on Lake Erie, you know, more than I ever have. And so I put a lot of my emphasis in that. I really haven't fished a whole lot of tournaments since I got out. Fish a couple a year. I got a buddy that I fish them with. But I really took the guiding really serious. And it was more the style that we fish. We're doing the casting and retrieving baits, working baits across the bottom, not the traditional out on Lake Erie, you know, the drifting and dragging tubes across the bottom. You know, that's kind of famous around, you know, in the Western Basin. I guess some guys doing the St. Lawrence River, you know, in that deeper water. But so I wanted to show people the way we teach, or, you know, the way we teach, the way we fish. And I got a lot of walleye guys that started going with me, and they were shocked at how much fun it is, because they've gone out with guys that troll, and now they feel like they're doing the fishing, they're doing the catching. I'm not trying to make fun of the walleye guys that troll, but those customer base, it was something new to them, you know, and it really opened up their eyes, and it's really turned into a, you know, I guide probably 50 to 60 days a year. And I've really opened up the, you know, some eyes to people how to bass fish and how much fun it is. And this kind of took me by surprise. I didn't realize that a lot of my customers were going to become friends. Like, I have a lot of people that I don't call them customers anymore. They're almost friends. And it gets weird that after the fishing trip that they give you money,
sure,
taking off fishing. And, but they all understand it's part of the gig. If I have to do it for part of my business. So the tournament bug is definitely getting back into it. I've been listening to some podcasts lately, and but now that I've got the, and I'm sure you've gone through it in your head and talked to your close buddies about it. When you get out and you get a clear head, like when I first got out, I didn't have a clear head. If I would have got back in it, like would have qualified the next year, I would have been just as much of a mess on the tour. And I probably have been just as unsuccessful. But now that I've been out 5 or 6 years, I have a clearer head. I think I probably would have, I would do a little better. That curiosity part really gets me wondering, but it's a heck of a gamble.
It is. I have that thought too. You know, after I was in the same situation you were, we just kind of ran out of money, $100,000 a year to fish on tour.
It's unbelievable.
I lasted 2 years. And it was, it was a shock wondering what are you going to do next? Because that's all you thought about. And so you bring up a really good point. I think, you know, we both kind of gravitated towards guiding and still staying in the fishing industry somehow. But that drive to get back, it's definitely there for me. But the passion that, and maybe this is better, you know, that driving real, like, keep you up at night, that's not there. And so that's scary for me too, because I'm thinking about trying to get back in, but, you know, I'm thinking of all these other individuals across the country that, you know, whether they be young anglers coming up through the ranks, or maybe a veteran that just wants to, you know, that always wanted to fish professionally on one of the major tours, they got that, like, can't sleep at night, focused, driven attitude, which I don't seem to have. But I want to be there. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense to me. But I think of it this way. it's all up here. So much of it. I'm thinking like 80, 90, 95%, somewhere in that frame of what goes on out there. I mean, I would think that I think we would make better decisions. And because of those decisions, we could do better than those younger kids that don't. I mean, I was that kid that couldn't sleep when, or I wasn't a kid at the time. I was like 28 or 29 when I got in, and, or no, I was 30, 31 or 30, whatever. Yeah, but yeah. I mean, I couldn't sleep. I was wondering, I was like, man, what is wrong with me? And it's, you just get so balled up. But there's just so many times in tournaments, and I won't go on this, we'll get to smallmouth talking here, but think of how many times you, like, all right, me personally, like I was just a moron. One of my strategies to go into these tournaments, I love throwing a frog so much, you know, my largemouth fish. I mean, but I would have three good fish in the boat, and I would continue to go, like, I would never bail and say, all right, just pick up the drop shot, the shaky head, go hit some points and go catch some 13 inches and get out of here. Mm-hmm. And I look back at the results about, you know, how many tournaments I would miss a check by a pound or two, and I would weigh in three fish on one day or four the next. And I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. What is that? Yeah, it's nuts, right?
Yes, it's I just considered an expensive, a learning curve, expensive learning curve, really, is what it was.
It was something, but
we may get back there someday. Yeah. But, who knows? But obviously, your passion now, guiding on Lake Erie, you have a successful business. I imagine a lot of that guiding's done in the off season for you as a teacher during the summer months and then probably the weekends.
Yeah, that's correct. So usually my school district gets out first week of June, maybe early part of the second week. But up until then, I do weekends in April and May. And then in May, I'll do a couple trips after school, like a 4 or 5 hour trip. So that's kind of how I roll. And then once school gets out, I'm usually until about the second week of July, I'm pretty much every day. Until I, but you know, you get blow days where you don't get out. And so there's days off work their way in.
Well, talk to me about that, because I know there's probably a lot of people that maybe have been on Lake Erie in the past or thinking about coming up in that Sandusky area all the way, you know, the islands and Pelee into Canada, you know, that whole section of Lake Erie. Well, first of all, every section of Lake Erie seems to fish a little bit different, but that section of Lake Erie, you have the opportunity to catch both good largemouth and smallmouth. And you just mentioned with the winds and things like that, that come up when you got a guy that, you know, maybe drove 5-6 hours to go out and fish with you and it's blowing and he wants to go catch smallmouth. You got some options for those people up there?
You do. And I kind of, and I, you know, whether it's in the boat or I talk to them and I just say, listen, I've never met you before. This is our first trip together. I don't want to insult your fishing IQ, but I kind of want to know if they can use a bait caster, how well they can cast a spinning rod, because if it's blowing real hard, we're going to, like, I got some frog and fish going in some of the bays or whatever. I mean, it's not very fun to go throwing a frog when there's, you know, when the frog's blowing across the mats or you got to flip in some pads. And so then there's a bunch of canals in the harbors and you got to work our way back there. But if you can't put the jig or whatever you're throwing up next to the pole, you know, it might not be a good option for them to even make the drive over here. So I try to just be, I have learned this, and it's, you know, the more honest you can be with your customers, the better off everybody's going to be. And to be, you know, and by just asking more questions and finding more about them, because I have assumed that people early on in my guiding, that people could cast a bait caster and make a pitch up next to a dock that we can just do with ease. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean? And not everybody can do that. So, you know, asking those questions up front, you know, it just makes everything so much smoother. And I mean, the last thing I want to do, whether they're coming from Columbus or east of Cleveland or wherever, I don't want anybody getting up at 3 or coming the night before and then just having a miserable trip. Mm-hmm. So, and then I even ask them questions about what they think of rough water. You know, I don't like to take the guys out and have them fishing in 3-footers. I mean, 3-footers aren't fun to fish in, no matter if you're by yourself, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. we always fish on the calm side of the islands. But if they're like, I am not a big water guy, I'm like, well, the winds are not looking like it's a day for you. Mm-hmm. And if I have a day open, we just push them but a lot of times, you know, they just book for the following year.
Right. So, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, talk to me a little bit about the smallmouth fishing on Erie. You know, you grew up doing it. How have you seen the fishing change over the years?
Yeah. So being in the club, we had a few tournaments out there every year. But as the tournament, my tournament life got rolling, I really focused more on largemouths, you know, and then, once that kind of got a bigger boat and started going out there more, you know, smallmouth started becoming more important in my life. And I really like getting away from people. Like, I'm kind of beyond the point of, you know, going into the harbors and just going around the circles. I don't know what, if it's being around, being a teacher, being around tons of people all day long, I just like to get away. Mm-hmm. But Erie got really, really tough. Like, you know, in the mid-90s, you know, it was just like there was tons of three-pounders early, you know, turn of the century. You know, it was just awesome. And then when the gobies came in, I mean, so the word is the gobies came in, you know, and they just exploded. The biologists say that that was a major problem. And then the walleye fishing took a real tank. And then I guess a lot of charter captains started going after walleye or going after bass, you know, and I guess they kept them. So between those two kind of hitting at the same time, and that was about 2007, 8, 9 in that area. I mean, you would go fishing all day long to your best stuff, you know, and you might catch 5 fish. Really? And I was like friends with, I'm good friends with, not, I'm not going to like just throw names out, but I'm really good friends with Joe Balog, you know, and he was out there all the time, and he was very generous with, you know, techniques and things he would use out there. So, and his buddies were all, you know, in the network of the tournament guys. And I mean, it was just tough. I mean, it was very, very tough out there. Hmm. And then, you know, fishing out there now it's slowly, like, I'm starting to use the words, it's getting back to where it was. It's not to where it was in the late 90s in that time frame, but I think it could. There was a, you know, there was a closed season catch and release that was put in place. I don't know what year it is, but I think that helped a lot with, you know, with the fishing. Now they just put in, you can keep, I don't know what they, now you can keep an 18 incher and that's your trophy between May 1st and June 28th or whatever. Hmm. So if you can keep one fish 18 inches and over, and they call that a trophy, and it's a great fish. That's a fun fish for a customer. But everybody I talk to says, man, it's not even that big of a fish. So right. I hope a bunch of 18 inches don't start being pulled out, you know, and the gobies, I'm kind of getting tired of the goby talk. I mean, are you getting tired of the goby talk? Everybody keeps talking gobies, gobies, gobies. And
well, what do you mean?
Like, what, gobies are important, what? But like, the goby population is like way down. I've gone to some seminars where the biologists have spoke, you know, and in their creel nets, they're not getting as much as what really? They were. And I'm catching so many fish out of Lake Erie now. It's like just fouling around waiting for balls of bait to come underneath your boat and dropping on them and catching them. And they're spitting up little perch, white perch, yellow perch. They're spitting up baby walleyes. I mean, a lot I'm seeing, because there's so many walleye out now. It's like the best walleye fishing, I guess, mm-hmm. of years and years. And there's tons of little walleye out there, like the size of a pencil or smaller. And I'm getting a lot of bass to spit up walleye.
Really? So they're targeting small, I guess, 1 or 2 year old perch walleyes.
Yeah, a little white perch. I mean, they're still eating. I mean, they're still definitely eating. Like, I'm not saying they're not eating gobies. They are definitely eating gobies. But it's not like that goby boom that we all made, you know, the Great Lakes popular.
Those schools that you're seeing of bait fish, is there also like a shad population, alewives, or what else is going on?
Oh, gizzard shad are booming right now on the lake.
Okay.
Walleye are eating them. And I've talked to a couple of buddies. I mean, they're pulling full, like, hand size gizzard shad with pliers out of smallmouth throats, like you would see coming out of a Kentucky lake bass.
So are they starting to roam more?
Yeah, I think they are. Spring, you'll see them more. Late spring, you know, when they get off, most of them are done bedding. They'll kind of stay shallow for a few more weeks. You know, they're real easy to catch. You know, there'll be multiple times, you know, back to the gobies real quick, they'll just start just throwing up gobies that are 2 inches long. Like, you'll see 8, 9 gobies just all spit up there. But I'm seeing more of the, you know, the bait fish, whether it's the, you know, little walleyes, either of the perch, yellow or white perch, kind of like definitely everything's post spawn and they're starting to move off. But like a lot of the times when I'm out there fishing, you know, and pretty much the shallow stuff, and obviously say shallow stuff's 15 foot or less, is pretty much done with. You know, you'll get into your areas where they used to hold on these rocks, you know, and you might catch one real quick. It seems like always first 5 minutes or first cast, usually, you know, you throw right to the juice and you catch them right away. Mm-hmm. And then you don't catch anymore. And then you just start milling around from waypoint to waypoint in a small area. And then you just start seeing these balls of bait that start popping up. And they're about the size of your boat, you know, and you, and I don't even mark any fish underneath them, but I just drop my bait on them and I catch one. Really? And then I just sit around that area and I just keep plunking them off like that. So I think there's more fish now on the Western Basin of Lake Erie, maybe up on the water column now, mm-hmm. roaming with the fish, maybe even with the walleye, than what they were in the past.
So you're really good. I'm assuming you're really good with your electronics when it comes to finding these roaming fish. You know, there's a lot of different species in Lake Erie. Of course, yeah. The sheephead, drum, walleye, and then the bass. Are you able to determine really what type of fish that is when you do see them on the graph or not?
So I think I use a graph pretty effectively. I would not say I'm like a Paul Mueller or one of those guys, not even close. I'm a very impatient fisherman, you know. So I get in the area where there's rocks. I can't tell if it's a bass or not. I'm looking for a fish, looking for around the rocks. If I see a fish that looks like it's right on the side of the rock or maybe hovering a foot above it, you know, mm-hmm. I'm thinking it's a good chance it's a bass. But it could be, it seems like the sheephead are more definitely on the bottom tight. But if I see that and I see some bait in the area, it gives me some confidence. But if I'm not getting bit in 15 minutes, I'm rolling on to the next waypoint. And I, even for my guide trips, you know, most of my customers do 6 hour trips. And, you know, a big thing on, you know, around there, I've got so many waypoints. I kind of just roll through them. Mm-hmm. And through the years, I've kind of got a system where I know the times of the day that the fish bite the best, you know. And being out there every day, that's huge, being out there every day, really seeing what areas the fish are starting to leave at, you know, where some new groups of fish are coming in at. But, you know, when they start pushing off, I mean, and I'm looking for those balls of bait, if I mark them, it gives me some confidence and I see the bait, yeah, but I'm definitely not, even fun fishing, I mean, we're going to give it 15 minutes and then we're probably going to be mm-hmm. moving.
So just because they're...
Go ahead.
What would be the bait of choice or technique when you are, you know, sitting on the ball of bait fish and you mark them, but you might not have marked fish, but you say sometimes you can drop down, you know, one will magically appear. There might be a handful around. What's the technique that you're go to in those situations?
Yeah. Drop shot pretty much. You know, mm-hmm. you know, the Z2 is awesome bait on Lake Erie. I used to like the Berkeley Gulf Fry. Was awesome. I started my own little lure business called Venture Lures. I got a bunch of little stupid little baits. They work really well. I think there are certain properties in a bait that work real well. And I think you sound like you're a total tackle junkie. So you have probably ran the mill of baits that you've tried for drop shots. And you've probably got 10 that you would feel confident using on a tournament day, mm-hmm. and you probably have 10 more baits that look great that are just junk that you're like, man, I cannot believe this bait doesn't work. Mm-hmm. There's something about it that I think if you play with these baits and you feel them and you watch them in the water, they have very similar traits that make them good fish catching baits, I think. So I think as long, and for me, you know, unless you're going with an airy darter, which is a heavier plastic with salt. And if you ever looked at it on your line, it's an awesome bait out there, but it like falls down and it's so heavy, right. And it looks ridiculous, but they say it looks like a perch, but to me, like a plastic that floats. Okay. But the floating, they kind of go like this, which makes it look unnatural to me, but some sort of floating and it's soft and they don't last long. Those mm-hmm. are the ones that are the best. That's kind of a rule I go with. And you get your basics, like a green pumpkin with some sort of purple gold. Like that Z2 and the Smoky Shad's a good one, you know, that color. But I mean, I think everybody's pretty much using the same stuff anymore. I mean, guys that are somewhat in the know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For the most part, I think that's certainly what's going on when it comes to bait selection. You know, there's a handful of good ones out there, and there's, like you said, there's a handful that you just wonder why you can't get more bites on that bait. But you know, who really knows? There's a lot that to be said about being able to watch your bait. You know, I do a lot of testing in the fish tank, and I'm sure you have too. And I know you've even taken a step further and did a little scuba diving on some of the smallmouth structure. So I do want to talk about that. But before we go there, I'm real curious before we leave these bait fish oriented smallmouth, do you see a difference as far as how they suspend based on the wind conditions? So if you have a real calm day, do you notice any difference on how those fish react to the bait fish in the water column versus a day when it's blowing really hard?
Yeah, I see, and I've been out there diving slick, sunny days, and to me, they tend to suspend even, you know, 3-4 foot up into the water, you know, maybe 5 foot.
On those calm days.
Yeah, on those calm days. And sometimes I feel like I'm getting onto something where, you know, the suspended fish don't bother me as much, but man, it's some days, I don't know. Fishing's such a crazy, that's half the reason we like it. You think you get it dialed in, you're like so pumped to go back out there again. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow, that's out the window. That's not the deal. I thought I was onto something, but you think, who knows? There's so many factors with fishing. Like, did the bait get out of the area? And that's why they're not, you know, and when they got hunkered down on the rocks now, you know, so, but yeah.
It's hard to keep track of those fish when they are chasing those schooling bay fish. The reason why I asked that is I had one of my best days last year on Lake Ontario in about 35 feet of water, and those fish were down 15 feet. And it was an amazing day. I was by myself, you know, just me and the fish. And dude, I could never get on that deal for the remainder of the year. That was it. One and done.
You know, I hate to, I mean, you're probably thinking the same thing. That might be like a 1 or 2 time lifetime deal. I mean, that seems like kind of special, like 15 foot. That's like a super suspended deal.
Crazy.
You could have hit the perfect storm type of thing.
I thought I was going to crush them all year doing
that.
Like, you know, it was a finesse technique where it was a small 16th ounce jig head with a real small, you know, fluke type of bait and just shaking
and you're
it
like
15 feet down. You just they were everywhere, dude. Like,
and you're probably like, I don't even know if I'm going to tell my buddies. I'll tell a couple. Probably.
No, I was, dude. I was on the phone with my buddies all day. Cause I was like,
yeah,
this is crazy. And at the time I didn't make a video of it because, you know, I was obviously LiveScope was helping and you know, last year I was very protective about it just because I didn't want my competitors to get it. But now everybody's got the stuff. And so, you know, I kind of lost the opportunity to really showcase how special those electronics were. And then, of course, add it to the bait I was using was somewhat unique. Give you a little hint. Paul Mueller throws it a lot.
Yeah.
But it was a very cool situation. But anyways,
vertical, straight up and down.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. It sounds like almost like what those guys in Oklahoma with the crappie fish and with the, you know, with the Panoptix scanning until they find them and, you know, dropping the bait or I don't know what Matt does, but you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So tell me about the scuba diving. Like, how long? What got you into that? Was it to specifically check out fish structure and what goes on?
Yeah, it was specifically to get underneath the water and, you know, stare at the fish. It's, you know, the cameras are cool, but it's still so different because I imagine you play with cameras, you got the waves and you can never get a great picture, but when you get down there, it's definitely have learned. So like with the algae blooms on Lake Erie, and I don't know if this is true, but there's some areas that are notorious. I've caught, consistently caught bass off of over the years. And now I can't catch a fish off of. And I talked to another buddy and he's kind of experienced the same thing. So I dove on one of those spots. It's, you know, out of North Bass and, you know, went right down and it's like 19, 20 foot of water. Yeah. And it's, you know, right on my numbers, went to it and it's got this like hard blanket of like carpet, the foam stuff. And I don't know if that's like the algae as it dies, it goes down there and just covers the rocks and compacts it. But
I'm shocked right now. You're talking about foam and rocks on the bottom and LG.
I don't know if it is. I'm just saying that I've learned, I guess.
It's a different bottom than what you expect.
Yeah, I feel like some rocky areas are not rocky anymore. And it's not, I mean, most of our rocky areas are still rock, but there are some areas that had a big rock and, you know, some boulders. And then there's a groove from the glaciers. And now it's got this soft, foamy stuff.
Blanketed over by perhaps the algae that's dying.
Possibly. Yeah. Or maybe the current shifted and some sediments got rolled into there and covered it all up. But that's kind of, you know, scuba diving showed me that. But the coolest thing is when they're spawning. You know, I go into the areas where they spawn, and I've learned that you got your areas where they're spawning. You can roll swim bait through there, and, you know, it's just easy. Or tube, whatever. You know, when you catch a lot of threes, you know, catching some fours, maybe catch a big one, you know, like a five or whatever. But what I've noticed is that you get into some of these areas that are a little bit away from the larger spawning areas, and you find a couple of giant rocks. And I have seen some of the bigger fish, the bigger ones and the fours and the fives, all by themselves, next to these rocks, these giant rocks. There's a shipwreck at one of the islands, you know. And there was just this monster tucked up underneath the shipwreck, like almost in this like cavern area. Wow. You know, I got him on film with my camera. You know, I'll have to email you some of the stuff.
Sure.
And he came out from the shipwreck, bit my camera, and then raced back in. I mean, just stuff like that. So I think there's some real tricky spots where some of these larger fish, you know, spawn at. Area with the winds down here and the shallow water, it some days it gets turned up, and you need to see some good scuba diving water. I mean, you need 7, 8, 10 foot of visibility to be like, wow, this is cool.
Could you bring the equipment and I would actually be able to scuba dive that day?
Like, yeah.
Is this something you can pick up and learn quick?
It's so easy. Like, all you do is you put this, you know, the breather in your mouth, and you like learn how to use the regulators to, you know, put air in your tank and some basic breathing things. But yeah,
that's cool. For example, you'll go out to a shipwreck and take a look at that. What describe like a shipwreck on Lake Erie, because there's a lot of shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. And, you know, obviously it depends on the year the ship went down. You know, there's ships from the 1800s and ships from the 1920s and 70s. So a variety of different ships. Some are more wood and some are more steel, I would imagine. What is a ship, you know, what is a big, I don't know, tugboat or a metal piece of equipment that's down there? What does it look like? Is it covered up by zebra mussels? Is there, you know, what's it typically? Because when I fish a lot of this, just man-made structure, I call it, you get to some of that real gnarly stuff, man. Sometimes it's a gamble whether or not you're gonna get a bite, but are you gonna be able to pull them out of that stuff?
Yeah, the one, there's a real famous one on the east side of Kelly's Island. You know, it's up in like 15 foot of water, and the water on Lake Erie is a little high right now, but they got some buoys marking it, so you know, boaters who don't have chips can stay clear of it. I'm not sure if they know what those buoys are marking, but you know, and there's a part of it that comes down about 3-4 foot of the surface. So it's pretty close, but you know, once you dive on it, you know, you get under the water and you're kind of just the first time you're like, man, that is awesome. But then, I mean, it kind of like, you see some small bass and some rock bass swimming around. And as you start moving around, you know, you might, and you know, depends on when you're there. If it's May, you'll find a bunch of different size of fish there, but it's just kind of this big orange and brown glob of metal sitting there, and you see this, and you see some poles coming down, you see some beams coming up. So it's not an old wooden one. I mean, but there was some wooden beams on it, but it's just this old gnarly zebra slime coated ship down there. And you can definitely see there's some deep shipwrecks out an area, you know, tons of them. And you can definitely see, like, if you were to cast at a distance to it, and you can barely bring your bait over top of it, whether it's a tube or a drop shot, I mean, you just almost get hung. And it makes totally sense why. Because if you pull it over this cable and then you open your bail, it'll fall back down again and it gets somewhere crazy and all these crevices. I mean, I would assume the best way to fish a shipwreck effectively would be almost vertical, where you could kind of, you know, pitch it out and work it through these different sections of it.
We hear a lot about that technique in the past. Is fishing shipwrecks on Erie still a viable way to do well in tournaments?
I would assume so. I mean, there's some out in Canada that, you know, were notoriously well or really good for a few guys. I don't fish them. I've tried. You got to be. Well, a spot lock would definitely help much mm-hmm. more now, mm-hmm. but they're kind of a pain in the butt. You know right. what I mean?
So, absolutely.
So I get frustrated pretty, right? I can get pretty frustrated on the lake if it's blowing and things aren't going well. So I try to reduce my frustration levels. Mm-hmm. Staying away from shipwrecks is one of those.
What do you think your strength is when it comes to fishing for smallmouth, whether it be a technique or maybe locating fish? What do you rely on?
Sight of and jam was the number one thing that helped me start skyrocketing my ability to go out and catch smallmouth. Four women, you know, the old sonars, straight up and down, 2D. I didn't know what I was looking at. I mean, literally, I would talk mm-hmm. to my buddy. I'm like, dude, you have got me lost. And I would kind of just drift a little bit, catch a fish, throw a buoy, cast around. And that's just my routine. You know what I mean? But sight imaging, you know, it showed me how big some spots are now. And that has really been the number one tool for helping me locate fish. But then as far as baits, you know, I really like catching them on jerk baits. I mean, some days I feel like I could just do it all year, but the window on Lake Erie Western Basin is pretty small for me for throwing jerk baits. You got, you know, for me, third, fourth week of April, first two weekends of May. And it's pretty close mm-hmm. to being done. I mean, you could catch them, but you got to work. Once they start, you know, finishing up spawning, you know, there's different groups of fish that move in for spawning, but throwing a crankbait mid-depth, you know, 10, 12 foot, I absolutely love. Like I have got other fishing by myself. Like I'll just chase a crankbait bite because I know it's happening somewhere at some depth and I can't get it going.
Is that typically a year-round deal, cranking?
No. Usually, for me, I stop doing it, you know, first week of July. Something like that.
What is your crankbait of choice?
I like to rotate through quite a few. You know, okay. The Strike Kings series, threes and fours are good. I like the DT and that perch color, you know, that 10. The Normans, their deep little lens. Mm-hmm. I was throwing that, and it's a popular one over this way, that C-Flash, it's a balsa bait. But those four, Berkeley's Dredger, that small one that goes down to 10 foot, it's got a real small body and it casts like a bullet. So I kind of use them all. I think if there's a good crankbait bite going on, I probably wouldn't have all Strike Kings on, you know. I like mm-hmm. to fish through an area with different baits, different action.
Okay, so you'll go through a section, catch a few fish, and then show them something different.
Yeah, line size, I like a graphite rod for them. You know, I feel like the sensitivity and, you know, a little bit stiffer graphite, you know, mm-hmm. crankbait rod is what I like. 12 pound fluoro, and I really dig into covering water, like a long cast, probably almost burning it. Like if you were to burn a spinnerbait, I'm bringing it back like this and stopping it, and it's a definitely work. But I feel like, you know, with that clear water, you can get some of those fish that don't want to react, you know, just because of smallmouth mentality, you know, the way they are, you can get some of those fish to bite. And, you know, I lose some because of that. They're not rarely, I mean, I get on the bites where the fish are sideways in their mouth and it's great. And you know, you can feel them that their fish has got the bait sideways just by the way they're reeling them in. You know, you feel that more of a thicker weight coming in. But a lot of times when you're speed reeling like that and they're not in that mood to eat, you know, you know, there's one hook in their mouth and for a tournament time, I'd like to maybe find them real quick with the crankbait for the tournament and probably not sure if I'd gamble on getting them in the boat. I'd probably want to slow down with the Ned rig or something that's a more high percentage bait.
After that kind of July-ish, you're really relying on the drop shotting. A typical setup on Lake Erie, what does that look like?
18 inches, mm-hmm. you know, most of the time. Man, I've been playing with going up to like 2 and 3 foot. You know, that's what's something I want to start doing more of. Is, you know, expanding that based off of our talking earlier about the fish suspending more, you know, a lot of, you know, I'm diving out there. I've seen, you know, I've gone out to the islands in Canada and dove out there And it's cool. You get to the bottom and it's like, man, I'm all by myself. This is kind of wicked. And then you start going to where you think your rocks are at. And then you kind of check out what's going on. And all of a sudden you turn around, there's six smallies swimming with you, like your buddies, and you're all heading to the park to play, you know? And then, so I sit there and I just watch them and they're just all just swimming around like in a big aquarium. I'm kind of wondering, are they up because I'm up? But I'm marking those fish at that same depth. You know what I mean? So I think that's where they're just hanging out. And like we said earlier, you know, that was a sunny day. And they, you know, like to suspend it, I think, in that 4 or 5 foot range. And they'll have, you know, these were just giant rocks, like the size of, like, you know, like a big, decent sized rock out there, you know, that I like to fish is, you know, the size of a lawn tractor, John Deere. So if I can get like 4 or 5 in those areas and like, you know, 10, 15 boulders the size of basketballs mixed in with it. That's like, I just envision that that's like their home base. That's their house. And everywhere around it, it's just like their big yard. And they kind of go exploring around, but it seems like they always come back to that house where they live, you know? One cool thing that I've learned through guiding, through retying baits or whatever, if you're fishing a spot like that, a specific spot with some rocks and they stop biting, you know, and the wind kind of rolls you off those rocks and all of a sudden you start getting bit and it's just bare, like nothing. I think those fish have pushed off because of the pressure of that, you know, of the boat being so close to them for a while. And now they're just kind of hanging out there out in their yard, like I called it earlier, until the pressure leaves and then they'll kind of push back up a little bit. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting you say that, because when you're really intimate, I guess you could say, with a spot, and I can picture a few of those situations in my mind where I might have a rock boulder and we'll catch some fish off of it. They'll get smart. And in fact, it's a shallower spot than I'm thinking of in my head. They see you, you see them. And they like to kind of scoot out, and they in their yard, like you were saying, they're going to head. But to me, they always go to the same part of that yard, which is a bare spot as well. Well, there's nothing else around this boulder, but they don't go this way or 40 yards that way. I tell my clients, okay, well, the school's broken up. They're 30 yards this way, and they're always there. It's crazy.
So, and when that happens, and I totally agree with what you just said, and so then last year I kind of re-rigged my depth finders. So I had two up front, one up front, and I was sharing it with my console at my driver's seat. Mm-hmm. So then my customers in the back of the boat, I could see what they were seeing, and I could say, hey, there's fish underneath you. When that way they wouldn't have to be constantly staring at the graph. I could say, there's fish underneath you. Mm-hmm. And I said, you got to drop it right next to the engine, because that's, you know, the closest spot where the fish was. And so there's a little learning curve. They would reel up real fast, and then they would toss the bait like, I'm like, no, it's got to be right there. Sure. The fish is not over there. But once I get it all, it's really cool to see them all, you know, it all start to connect with them and they start to get it. And usually by that time they really get it down, it's time to, you know, get back to the ramp.
Right, right. Well, if you're not used to fishing big water, I would suggest hooking up with someone like Michael that has the experience that'll really shorten your learning curve out there. You know, there's so much that goes into it. I could literally talk for 2 hours just about drop shot weights. You know what I mean? There's so many different scenarios when it comes to fishing deep water.
Hey, real quick.
Yes.
What's your number one size of drop shot weight? Like if you could ever just go all year, if you could only take one size.
Oh, all you're asking me these tough questions.
Yeah, man.
If I can only have one?
Yeah.
Well,
you have to use it shallow. And you can't cut it in half or snip it off like
3/8.
All right. Me too. That's what I was wondering.
But I have a 5/8 on most of the time.
Oh, okay.
I like to get down quick for deep water, not shallow. Right. Now I'm supposed to ask you that question. I got to ask you this, because we try to ask this with every guest on the podcast. If you had one bait that you could use the rest of your life, what would that be for smallmouth?
It'd probably have to be a tube.
A tube.
Just, you know, I like to crack a tube, you know, and come a real fidgety fisherman. And that would give my cranking, my jerkbait, you know, kick in to really snap it hard. And I do. But I think it would just have to be.
And then what color?
Dark melon or green pumpkin, purple, green good pumpkin, choice. Purple gold, something like that.
Yep. Let's talk about tube fishing real quick, because it's not as simple as some people think, and it's not as complicated either as some people might think. But when you mention cracking a tube, that in some people's mind, I think they're not quite sure what that means, because I think everyone might have a different vision of what, how much movement or how you do that. What, first of all, I want to know exactly what you mean by that. And second of all, I want to know, when does that benefit over, say, just dragging a tube?
Yeah. So if I kind of fish it where I, you know, have a group of fish located in a, maybe like a smaller area. Well, I can use, you know, both different ways, you know, big area, big flat, you know, where I know there's a bunch of fish just scattered, you know, a bunch of different ways, or a, you know, a small specific spot where I, but, you know, but they're not biting. So, and I like to make a, just a giant cast. So most time I'm using a spinning rod, 7.5 foot, fairly long handle on it, so I can really bury that, you know, that rod. 8 pound straight fluorocarbon is what I like to use. I don't like to snap a tube with braid on it. You know, I like that stretch from the fluorocarbon.
Okay.
You know, a lot, and most time I'm using a 1/2 ounce. And then I like to just like literally heave the bait as far as I can possibly get it. And it looks like you're trying to like work out a rat's nest on a bait caster. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you got to figure out what, you know, what depth. I like to crack it like in, you know, 15 foot or less most time, cause I'm too impatient to wait for it to get down into like 20 or 25. But once it gets to the bottom, customers don't understand this is, you know, if they're going to do that with me is that, and they're like, when's the bait on the bottom? The bait's on the bottom usually when the, you know, the line stops falling and you see the rainbow, you know, I say, look at the reverse rainbow, you know, and then once your line's laying on the water, you know, that's when most time your baits hit the bottom. So close the bait, you know, your bail by hand. And then I just start going like this, like 3 times super hard.
Really?
And then, so, and then usually I'll let it sit for a second and then I'll do it like one more time. And then I just, and it's still way out there. And then I just reel it back in and I don't even like keep snapping it all the way back to the boat. And the reason I do that is most time when I'm snapping a tube like that, it seems like they bite on the initial fall, almost like when a puncher's flipping a mat and the, you know, and the weight goes through the mat. They all, I mean, everybody, it's, you know, it's an awesome way to catch them. They say 90% of the time that hits on that initial fall. My experience, the way I do it, you know, on that initial fall, when that tube hits the bottom and I go to snap it, usually on the first or second snap, he's already on it for me.
All right. So let me walk this. Let's walk this through in my head. You're out there 15 feet of water or less. And what are you, maybe a flat or I guess anything that's holding fish?
Yeah.
Long cast. As soon as it hits the bottom,
I like to do as soon as it hits the bottom.
As soon as it hits the bottom, you're cracking it 3 times.
I like to go 3 times, but usually
and your first, and the rod tip is pointed like sideways up or straight up.
Yeah, it's about 11 o'clock, between, you know, around that 11 o'clock, and that's, so I'll go like, yeah, so about 11 o'clock, and I'll go like this 3 times.
And three just quick.
Three quick, but whoa, usually they're on it on this first or second crack.
So they're biting it as you're,
I think they're seeing it fall to the bottom is what I think.
Okay.
I think the bait's coming down the bottom super fast, more.
Well, I mean, three, a half quick, ounce. That thing's just like, it's shooting up and then that's yeah, quick. And they're just grabbing it. And then, so after three, then it was a pause.
And then I'll do it again. Maybe, one maybe not. I'll just do it one more time. Like not 3 times, like just literally one more time.
And then you reel it back
in. I reel it all the way back in. The only reason I do that is because there's so many times, and you know, all the other smallmouth guys that do it will probably like, he's nuts, he's missing some fish. But I have stroked it all the way back to the boat, and I seem to only catch them like 25% of the time. And so I feel like that's just wasting my time. If more casts I can make and get them to probably bite it on that fall or on that second crack, if I can make 15 more casts than you, I have the chance to catch maybe 3 or 4 or 5 more fish, I'm thinking.
So they probably saw that bait on the initial drop, and then by the time they reacted and got over to it, they're biting on that second or third crack.
Mm-hmm. And like, it seems like, you know, with a 7.5 foot, you know, fast action rod, I hardly ever lose them that way. You know, cracking. I don't know what it is. You know, a real good hook to use that I love to crack with is that Gamagatsu Ashaughnessy. You know, that sprout style hook. It's gold. For some reason, that when that hook rotates, like with a round bend, the rotation of that hook goes more and it seems like to pop out more. That hook rotates and that tip of the hook, I think, will come back and hit the fish more to stop that rotating more, you know, and that's why that, you know, that's a really good hook, you know, for a heavy ounce. You know, you would think with a hook, you know, a half ounce weight, it'd be one that you would lose a lot of fish on. But
are you pouring your own tubes or are you finding that hook? Is that hook something that, that if people were interested, they can go find that somewhere?
I don't know of any companies. I'm working on one right now for my little company, you know, to jerk tubes with, but normally I'm pouring my own right now, you know, the modified do it mold. I don't know of any companies that have that hook in a tube hook. A lot of the ones are, you know, the 90 degree round bend, whether it's the Mustad or the Gamagatsu one, or the owner's got a good one. 20 years ago when I got in, there's only a select few good hooks. Now it feels like with everything, with electronics, rods, reels, everybody's got to have it good,
right?
Or they're not going to be around.
So listen, how can we get some of these hooks? Are they for sale? Are you going to sell them?
I am going to sell them, but it's all in the design stage right now.
Okay.
But it's going to be that hook. And the reason that hook's going to be really good is, you know, I like to use a 3.5, but the heavy plastic, you know, it's hard, you know, you're trying to get the eye and your line to go through it. It's got a, where the line tie meets the 90 degree bend, it's longer. And so that's going to stick out of the plastic more. It's going to make it easier to tie, but it's going to be a, you know, a heavy forward head, you know, so the bait wants to go down more. I feel like sometimes with the normal ones that are more, you know, the mold or, you know, the lead goes down the shank of the body. Mm-hmm. I feel like those might want to fall a little bit horizontal more versus vertical. And I want to get that bait to fall more.
So vertical. A 3.5-inch tube is the size.
Yeah, that's what I like. Yeah, and I like whether it's, I mean, Strike King is my tube, you know, that I like to use. And what, you know, the reason I like that is I like a
coffee
tube.
Coffee tubes or?
Yeah, just the coffee tubes. But I like, it doesn't even matter about the coffee. I don't really care about that. It's the way the body starts and the tail starts. It's like pretty much right in the middle. And they have a nice, you know where it's dipped, it's even. The tails are cut real nice. When you're stroking a tube, it drives me nuts is when you don't have a tube that, you know, where the tails are cut real nice, mm-hmm. and it balls up around your tail.
Yes.
Around the hook, and you're constantly.
I can't, if I have, so sometimes depending on the plastic in the tube, there's some really good tubes out there that have really good action. But during the process of making those tubes, sometimes, you know, it's an uneven cut or whatever the case may be. And so I have to take the time to spread them out, and I do that. I want to make sure everything looks perfect.
It's crazy, but it's like super important when you're fishing a certain way. Like if you're going to just pull across the bottom, you're probably not going to have an issue with it. But as soon as you start popping it, those tails, they get wrapped around the inside of that bend of that hook. And that's just going to cause so much spiraling, you know, in your line. And it seems like since you're fishing the tube so fast, I don't have a lot of issues with coiling.
You drag a tube on braid?
No. So
you're a fluorocarbon guy then, huh?
With my tube, like pretty much the only thing I'm using straight floral with these days is a tube.
This is critical because I'm trying to get this dialed in. So I'm looking for a 7.5. I'm getting some tube heads from you, no doubt.
Yep.
3.5-inch tube. And what size line fluorocarbon are you?
So I use 8, and I go with 8 because of the casting distance.
Sure.
You know, I really want to bomb it out there to get the, because then, I mean, you're really reducing the spooking of the fish because you are bombing the bait out there. The fish don't even probably know you're there, and they're just getting plunked off a lot of times.
What's the shallowest you're going to crack a tube?
5 foot.
Are you using a half ounce even in 5 feet of water? Or are you ever going a little less?
I have gone to 3/8, you know, but most time it's a
just
half.
Stick with a half regardless.
Yeah. Because, I mean, the bait's not really being dragged across the bottom to get hung in. And all you're looking for is a reaction. You know, I think sometimes we just need to make it a little bit more simple than what we're
well,
to do.
Well, it seems like that half ounce is going to probably give you the right action in fall rate that you're looking for to trigger that reaction bite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fun way. I mean, you can catch as many doing that if they're really on it. I mean, as fast as you can cast them. And sometimes you wonder, like, man, how many fish are in there?
Wow.
So, but if you get the school kind of worked up, they'll bite anything at a certain point. well, you know, once you get them going.
Wow, yeah. this was Michael, this was good stuff, man. Loving it. How can people, Michael, get a hold of you? What's the best way to follow you on social media?
I had a Facebook page for my guide service. It was the Simonton's Lake Erie Bass Fishing Guide Service. And I'm getting rid of that. I just kind of want to reduce my social media. Not a full-time guide. So I've got a lot of customers now that from previous years, I kind of take up all my days. So I kind of don't want to get bogged down with social media. I'm a school teacher, just had a son, have a little bait business. I don't want to have a, you know, one more thing, but I do have a Instagram. It's M Simonton Bass. Not very active. I'd like to start getting more active. My website's michaelsimonton.com. I am going to be starting to upload videos, you know, side imaging and things and, you know, on how I rig my boat. So if guys want to check that out, it's good to have guys like you to, you know, have me on. And I really appreciate you, you know, selecting me to be on this. I certainly don't consider myself a, you know, top 50 smallmouth
angler.
That's
what everybody says.
I know, but let's see, man. We are so, but I am so, like, I mean, looking at credentials, and I certainly don't have the credentials of top 10s like you and Scott on Lake Erie or on the Great Lakes. But I think I try to do best for my customers and clients and give them the best experience out there. And, you know, they want to catch fish. That's real quick. Another thing I really learned about, you know, all the hype from the Great Lakes, you know, everybody has these big dreams of catching those awesome. They do love it. But I've learned that people want to have someone that's nice out on the boat, you know, give them a good experience. And, you know, they want to catch some fish, you know, and teach them a few things. So I think I do a good job of that. You know, I really appreciate having me on.
Yeah, definitely. So the bait, what plastics are you currently selling now? Is there some more baits in the lineup?
I got a new football head here.
Okay.
But I had them drill these little holes in the bottom of it to hold the powder paint in more. So pulling across the bottom, you know, and it starts breaking off. I think that's going to hold the powder paint on there. And it's got a Gamagatsu hook on it and double barb. I got these in a ball head. You know, I sell a bunch. I just got some more in bags of my ball heads. So I got a new hook that I'm also going to be selling. You know, Hayabusa's got a really good hook. This is the 1/8 ounce on it, and I got 1/8 ounce with up to 3/0, and I got 3/16 with a couple different sizes, 5/16, a couple different sizes, 7/16, a couple different size hooks. So, like, I just got boxes like these laying all around with ball heads with Hayabusas and the Gamis. Here's one that I call the Skinny Mini. This is smoke purple flake.
So a Skinny Mini that resembles that's almost, I mean, that really is a good bait fish imitator, whether it be perch, shad, or a goby.
My favorite bait to use when I'm dropping on them, when I'm marking them on the graph, is one I call the dropper. And it's a stupid looking bait. It's less than 3 inches long, soft plastic, and this is a green pumpkin purple flake. But that's what it looks like. But the reason I like this bait is that it falls straight down. There's no twist on it. So when you mark them on your graph and you have, you know, 3/8 or 1/2 ounce, you want to get down, it's going to go straight down, you know, with your drop shot. And it's not going to twist as it goes down and take longer to get down there.
Okay.
And you know, it really works. It's soft floating plastic. And it's, I mean, it looks ridiculous. You know, I do a couple sport shows a year. Guy bought some 1 year. And he comes back to my booth next year. He's like, you know those baits you sold me last year? I was like, yeah. He's like, as soon as I left your booth, I was like, man, Simonton got me. Those things aren't going to catch a fish. He's like, man, I caught a bunch of fish on them. So,
sure. So for the listeners, that bait really was streamlined, and it had, I guess, the tail of the plastic was more of a circle or a ball, you could say.
It's just a little ball.
A ball.
It resembles like a goby because it's got a little fatter head. But I just kind of want to resemble the tail.
Sure.
Of a goby around, because when it's on its profile its side, you don't really notice it.
Yep.
I've just got a couple of eyeballs on the side of it, but
uh-huh.
I mean, I don't know what you think, Travis, but I think for smallmouth fishing, I think simple is better. It seems like I catch more fish with, you know, subtle baits versus baits where they have tons of action on them. And I know that, you know, that changes for sometimes, but it seems like largemouths, you know, can get on more action baits, you know, plastic for drop shotting. But I do real well with drab style baits, you know, with not a lot of action.
All right, Michael, that was pretty cool. A lot of good information. I really appreciate you coming on. You're welcome back anytime. and good luck in the future.
Hey, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. I really
awesome. Do. Until next time, guys, we'll see you on the water.
Thanks so much for listening today. Make sure that you're subscribed to the show and follow us on Instagram at Small Mouth Crush. Also, the YouTube channel, Small Mouth Crush. And if you feel so inclined, please leave us a 5-star rating and comment with a review below. And as always, until next time, we'll see you on the water.